Okay, I think we should get started. My name is Arne Westad. I'm one of the directors of the Cold War Center here at LSE. I just want to welcome you to this, the final lecture for this year in our series From the Cold War to the War on Terror. And I must say, on behalf of the center, this has been a very successful series so far. We had a very large number of people attending. We had some incredibly good speakers, as most of you will know. I recognize several of you from having been to many of these lectures. And it's particularly good for us that, as the very last speaker in the series for this year, we have Professor Margot Light from the International Relations Department here at LSE. And as we have said with the internal speakers from earlier on, Margot, indeed, is someone who needs no introduction at LSE. She is a former convener of the International Relations Department, and she is someone who has written a number of books on the Soviet Union, on Russia. Probably the most well-known is The Soviet Theory of International Relations, which is still a standard textbook for understanding the Soviet approach to foreign affairs. The one that has meant most to me is a collection that you edited a few years ago on the Soviet Union and the Third World, which has also had a significant impact within the field. As you will know, what we have tried to do with this series is to link the present with the past. We've tried to look at the Cold War in terms of how it created the fundaments for today's world. And this is what the other speakers in this series have focused on. It's particularly important for us for that reason to be able, in the final lecture, to focus on Russia, which, of course, played a significant role during the Cold War, created one of the poles that the Cold War is seen as being centered around. What we're trying to do today, what Margot will be lecturing on, are the links that connect the Russian and the Soviet past to the present, in terms of understanding the Russian approach to the war on terror. Margot, please.
Thank you, Arne, and I'm sorry to disappoint you, but my understanding of what most of the other speakers have done is to start by making the link and then go on to talk about the war against terrorism. And I'm afraid that that's more or less what I'm going to do, so you're going to have to put up with that.
As Arne, there is a little bit of the past in there.
As Arne said, this is the last in the series of lectures, and when I saw the lecture program, I asked myself whether there was a significance in the order of the lectures. Why was the lecture about Russia and the war on terrorism placed last, even after the round table discussion about the right and wrong lessons to be learned from the Cold War? I decided not to take it personally, so I quickly decided I couldn't afford to think it was the lecturer. And it certainly couldn't be because Russia's war on terrorism post-dated the war on terrorism. After all, Russia was the first country to proclaim that it was fighting a war against international terrorism. Nor could it be because Russia has nothing to do with the theme of the series, because as the legal heir to the Soviet Union, Russia was one of the two chief protagonists of the Cold War. And I resolved the problem eventually by deciding that the order reflects one of the main themes of my lecture, and that is that despite joining the coalition against terror in 2001, Russia's war against terrorism is very different from America's war against terrorism. In short, my intention is to demonstrate, first, that there are similarities between Russia's war and America's war, but the differences between them are greater than the similarities. Second, I want to show that the manner in which Russia fights its war against terrorism affects Russia's relations with the West. Third, I want to argue that in its pursuit of its war against terrorism, American policy often conflicts with what Russians perceive as their vital national interests. And finally, I shall argue that it is extremely unlikely that the measures that Putin has put in place will either eradicate terrorism or end the war in Chechnya. Now, in order to do this, I shall divide my lecture into four parts. I shall begin by saying something about the similarities and differences between the two wars against terrorism. Second, I shall talk about Russia's war on terrorism, concentrating particularly on Chechnya. Third, I shall indicate how America's pursuit of its war on terrorism infringes Russia's perceived national interests. And I shall conclude rather gloomily by arguing that Russia's war on terrorism is likely to continue because its continuation suits a number of players, and that contrary to what Foreign Minister Lavrov claimed last night, Putin's policies are ill-designed to win the war, and they have serious consequences for Russia's internal and external development. So let me begin then with the similarities and differences between Russia's and America's wars against terrorism. Insofar as the war against terrorism is a war against Al-Qaeda that began in earnest on 9/11/2001, and insofar as Afghanistan was the first battlefield in which it was fought, the war against terrorism clearly has its origins in the Cold War, and Russia, as the legal heir to the Soviet Union, and the United States must equally share the blame. The terrorist threat, of course, did not begin on 9/11, and Al-Qaeda did not suddenly arise in 2001. To quote Fred Halliday, Al-Qaeda did not arise from the subconscious of Islamic or Arab minds, but from the Cold War, in particularly the financing, the training and arming of tens of thousands of jihadi militants by the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan for the war against the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan and the Soviet Army in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And the civil war that finally resulted in the Taliban taking power in Afghanistan in 1996, while not caused by the Soviet Union, was certainly greatly exacerbated by the invasion in 1979 and the participation of the Soviet Army in the war. Halliday also argues that another legacy of the Cold War is the arrogance, ignorance, and instinctive resort to force that accompanies the exercise of power over other peoples. Halliday refers not so much to the conduct of the war itself, although I would include the conduct of the war, but to the exercise of power afterwards. And there is a similarity between Russia and the United States here. The difference is that whereas the perpetrators of ill treatment at Abu Ghraib and Camp Breadbasket are brought to trial, Russian forces who perpetrate similar and worse actions in Chechnya are not. And in the Russian case, I would add to the catalogue of examples of arrogance and ignorance and instinctive resort to force the callous treatment of the victims and survivors of terrorism, as witnessed during and after the Dubrovka theater siege and the Beslan siege, although perhaps carelessness with human life and disregard for human dignity are perhaps more a legacy of Stalinism than of the Cold War per se. Another similarity between Russia and the United States is their attitudes to terrorism, particularly the way in which the emotions aroused by terrorist acts against their respective homelands narrow the possibility of rational discourse about causes and thus the ability to canvass potential alternative responses. Any attempt after 9/11 to understand why Al-Qaeda had undertaken the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon was regarded by most Americans, and indeed by many people in Britain, as anti-American. Just as after Beslan, using the term rebel rather than terrorist to describe Chechen secessionists, or as Lavrov told us last night, resistance instead of terrorism to depict their actions is regarded as grossly anti-Russian. And surely this binary black and white, if you are not with us, you must be against us, categorization has its origins in the communist, anti-communist thinking of the Cold War. Final similarity worth noticing between Russia and the West's war against terrorism is the extent to which governments in the United States and Britain and Russia have responded to terrorism by reducing civil liberties in the name of defending democracy, and how little protest this has aroused from those whose freedoms are affected. I would argue that the apparent acquiescence of the vast majority of people to the curtailment of their civil liberties is motivated not just by a genuine fear of terrorism, but also by the desire not to be thought to be soft on terrorism. However striking these similarities, the differences between Russia's and America's war against terrorism are great. First, whereas the strength of the United States causes terrorism, state failure, not success, was the root of Russia's terrorist threat. Second, America's chief enemy in the war against terrorism is Al-Qaeda, even if implicating Al-Qaeda in the pressing danger represented by Saddam Hussein was scarcely credible. On the other hand, the terrorist threat to Russia originates primarily in Chechnya. There can be little doubt that terrorism in Russia originated in the two wars to prevent Chechen secession, and the very notion of terrorism in Russia has become synonymous with Chechnya. This means that although it is unclear what political goals Al-Qaeda is pursuing in relation to America, and therefore it is virtually impossible to imagine what kind of political solution could bring an end to terrorism directed against the United States, Chechen separatists have, or at least they had, clear political goals, and it is feasible, although almost impossible to bring about, to imagine a political solution which would remove the rationale for Chechen terrorism. Despite the local causes of terrorism in Russia, well before 9/11, the Russian leadership had frequently argued that Chechen terrorists were trained and funded by Osama bin Laden. After the Taliban took power in Afghanistan in 1996, Russians complained that Afghan-trained militants and mercenaries from the Balkans and the Middle East, they usually called them Wahhabis then, had moved into Chechnya. Throughout the year 2000, Putin used the term international terrorism to describe the enemy against whom Russia was fighting a second war in Chechnya. Since September the 11th, he has made an explicit link between fighters in Chechnya and Al-Qaeda. When President Bush launched his coalition against terrorism, President Putin, not without considerable opposition from his military, declared Russia to be a member. Russia's war against terrorism became part of the war against terrorism. In order to consider whether this reflects reality, let me say a little about Russia's war on terror. Now, I have to apologize here to those of you in the audience who already know a great deal about Russia and about the Chechen wars. Russia is a federation. It consists of 89 federal units, some of which are based on eponymous national groups and are called national republics, others of which are simply administrative regions. Chechnya is one of the national republics that makes up the Russian Federation. It is a small, mountainous republic in the North Caucasus. It is entirely within the Russian Federation, except for one short external frontier in the south that borders Georgia. Its population, about 1 million in 1989, was unusual in that in most of the national republics, Russians predominate. In Chechnya, however, 75% of the population was Chechen and 25% was Russian. The Chechens were mostly Sunni Muslim. Russia had expanded into the North Caucasus in the late 18th century, and the Chechens have fought them intermittently ever since. In 1944, Stalin deported almost the entire nation, about 500,000 people at the time, to Siberia and Central Asia, accusing them of collaboration with the German occupiers. In 1957, during the period of de-Stalinization, they were rehabilitated and permitted to return to Chechnya. And the map, which between 1944 and 1957 had no such thing on it as Chechnya, suddenly had Chechnya reappear in the form as a national autonomous national republic called Chechen-Ingushetia. In 1991, before the disintegration of the USSR, a nationalist movement came to power in Chechnya, led by a Soviet general who had been stationed in Estonia and had developed his secessionist taste by supporting the Estonians in their drive for independence. He declared the republic independent and separate from Chechnya, and Chechens neither participated in the 1993 referendum nor voted in the elections for the new Duma. Russian military intervention in 1994 led to a war that lasted until 1996 and ended in the defeat of Russia. The estimated losses in that war were 80,000 deaths and over 400,000 displaced persons. Prior to the first war, Chechnya had been a largely secular society, as both casualties and economic and political and social problems mounted during the war, disaffected Muslim groups became increasingly radicalized. Moreover, the conflict attracted religious volunteers recruited and funded from abroad. The War of Secession was gradually transformed into jihad, fought by means of guerrilla warfare and terrorism against Russia. Chechnya was reduced to ruins by the First War, and Russian funds promised for reconstruction either failed to arrive or were embezzled. General Maskhadov, who had been elected president of Chechnya in 1997, could not control the brutal warlords who operated in Chechnya by organized crime and a kidnapping. In August 1999, Chechen fighters crossed into the neighboring North Caucasus Republic of Dagestan to support a declaration by an Islamic body based there of an independent Islamic state in part of Dagestan and Chechnya. They were beaten back by local forces and the Russian army. A series of massive bombings of apartment blocks in Moscow, Volgodonsk, and Bunaysk in September 1999, which claimed more than 300 lives, was blamed on the Chechen rebels. Russia launched a second intervention, which led to the Second Chechen War that still continues today, although Moscow declares that this war has been over since 2002. In March 2003, Russia held a referendum in Chechnya and claimed a massive majority in favor of a new constitution stipulating that Chechnya was part of the Russian Federation. Later that year, elections were held and a pro-Moscow local government was put in place with Ahmed Kadyrov as president. The distinction that is usually drawn between terrorism and guerrilla warfare is on the basis that while terrorism is directed against civilians, guerrilla warfare is directed against combatants. There is also in Chechnya ordinary banditry, including frequent kidnapping for financial gain. Guerrilla warfare and terrorism are organized by the same leaders, financed from the same sources, and they have the same aims. Moreover, terrorist tactics like suicide bombings are used against Russian forces and against local pro-Moscow officials. Chechen terrorist attacks have been a feature of the war since 1995, some of them in Chechnya itself, but many of them in the rest of Russia. To give just a few examples, in 1995, a hospital was held hostage in Budyonovsk. In 1998, the Russian presidential representative in Chechnya was kidnapped, but probably more spectacularly, certainly for the Western press, was the kidnapping, murdering, and beheading of four engineers from Britain and New Zealand. In 1999, Russia's top envoy to Chechnya, General Gennady Shpigun, was kidnapped and murdered, and there was the series of massive bombings of apartment blocks that I've already mentioned. In October 2002, Chechen terrorists seized a Moscow theater and held about 800 people hostage. Most of the rebels and some 120 hostages were killed when Russian forces gassed and then stormed the building. In May 2004, President Kadyrov was killed by a suicide bomber. In August 2004, suicide bombers brought down two aeroplanes in Russia, followed within days in September 2004 by the siege of Beslan School in North Ossetia. In short, there is no doubt that terrorism has emerged as the major threat to Russian security. But it is also true, to quote Martin Wolf, that there has been a cycle of repression, Chechen revenge, and Russian retaliation. The Chechens are terrorists, and that is considered sufficient justification for atrocities perpetrated by Russian forces against ordinary Chechens. To say that Russia's savagery has inevitably radicalized the Chechen population is not to excuse terrorism, but it is to question the effectiveness of the responses that Russia, like most other governments faced with terrorism, has undertaken. Russia's conduct of the first war in Chechnya was the subject of criticism of the Council of Europe, the OSCE, the UN Commissioner for Human Rights, the European Union, and the governments of the United States and of most of Europe. Until 9/11, the second war in Chechnya was also criticized. After 9/11, the criticism became muted, but in the last couple of years, it has again become a feature of Russia's relations with much of the outside world. But the Russian response to terrorism is not just repression of Chechens. After Beslan, modeling itself on Bush's doctrine of preemption, Russia threatened preemptive action against terrorist bases abroad. And since it accuses Georgia of harboring Chechen terrorists in the Pankisi Gorge, there was little doubt that Georgia was intended to heed the warning. In fact, in early 2002, the United States sent military advisors to Georgia to train its forces for anti-terrorist operations and to help address the increasing lawlessness in the region. Perhaps for this reason, Russia's threat has not been implemented, but nor has it been retracted. Putin has also used Beslan as a pretext to continue his program of strengthening the Russian state. For Putin, the 1990s were not years of emerging political pluralism, as they are generally viewed in the West, but a decade of chaos. From Putin's point of view, decentralization under Yeltsin served to fragment the Federation and encourage the kind of regional separatism that Chechnya embodied in its worst form. As a result, he was convinced that restoring Moscow's firm grip over Russia's regions was necessary to preserve national unity and public security from the twin threats of secessionism and terrorism. This conviction was bolstered by the tragedy of Beslan and the inability of local authorities to either prevent or respond to the attacks, because there is no doubt that it was petty corruption that permitted the terrorists to bribe their way past checkpoints and into the school in Beslan, just as it was petty corruption that permitted the terrorists to board two planes at Domodedovo and bring them down shortly before the siege of Beslan. And it was unrestrained greed that caused former and present state functionaries to hive off key state assets, thus adding to the hardships and alienating local communities. Even before the Beslan tragedy, Putin had strengthened state control of the media, in part in order to control information about the Chechen war. He had attempted to increase the authority of the federal government by establishing what he called a power vertical, staffed predominantly by people from the security organs. For example, he created seven federal regions with governor generals in charge of each, the governor generals reporting to the presidential administration rather than being accountable locally. He also removed the regional governors from the federal council, the upper chamber of the Russian parliament. Since Beslan, Putin has repealed the popular election of regional governors, replacing the elections with a system whereby he nominates the governors and the regional legislatures are restricted to approving his nomination. And if they disapprove his nomination, he has the right to dissolve the legislature. He has also passed a law so that the next Duma will be elected entirely on the basis of proportional representation based on party lists. Previously, half the deputies were elected from single-member constituencies. Putin has moved away from Yeltsin's idea of a federation from the bottom up, suggesting instead that federalism in Russia can only be top-down. Mutual agreements are to be replaced by the delegation of power from the top, and the Russian Federation, in effect, reverts to the Soviet formula of federal in form but unitary in practice. The problem is that these reforms, in specifically and deliberately removing local participation in decision-making through the electoral process, are more likely to complicate Moscow's ability to govern the country effectively than they are to strengthen the state. They will also serve to depoliticize an already apolitical population, to increase the distance between the people who the people themselves and those who govern them. These measures, in short, undermine the fragile pluralism and democracy that Russia had achieved in its first decade. This is not the way to build civil society in Russia. Nor is it clear how these measures will reduce the threat from terrorism. Indeed, absent an end to the war in Chechnya, it is difficult to see what will eradicate terrorism in Russia. What is clear is that Putin's political changes have been the subject of much criticism from Russia's partners in the coalition against terrorism, notably last week in the run-up to the Bush-Putin summit, when Bush threatened to take Putin to task for backsliding on Russian democracy. I must say, however, that in the press conference after the summit, there was little sign that Bush had persuaded Putin that he was backsliding on democracy, rather more signs that Putin had persuaded Bush that he might have actually got it right. Nevertheless, it is quite clear that the political changes that Putin has introduced since the Beslan tragedy have become yet another issue, adding to the tension in Russia's relations with the United States that have arisen primarily as a result of America's war against terror. So I want to turn now to America's war on terror. As long as the coalition against terrorism was concentrated on the war in Afghanistan, American aims were compatible with those of Russia. But as soon as President Bush identified an axis of evil in 2002 that harbored terrorists and that aimed to produce weapons of mass destruction, it became clear not only that America and Russia did not have identical enemies, but that as America's pursuit of the members of the axis of evil would soon infringe Russian interests. Historically, The Soviet Union had good relations with North Korea and Iraq, and for most of its history, neighborly relations with Iran. In the mid-1990s, in an attempt to diversify Russian foreign policy, Russia had revived relations with both North Korea and Iraq. By that time, Russia already had very strong commercial relations with Iran, in particular supplying both the know-how and the wherewithal for a nuclear power station at Bushehr. In the year 2000, Putin appeared to have launched a particular form of what might be called niche diplomacy, devising for Russia the role of intermediary to assist these states that had previously been labeled rogue states to reintegrate into the international political system. And he hoped by these means to raise Russia's stature in the international political system. Now, Russian leaders think that they know their enemy, and their enemy is certainly not in Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. Russian intelligence officials believed that the threat from Iraq could be contained and managed, and Russia sees Iran as a stabilizing force in the Middle East, the Caucasus, and Central Asia, not as the state sponsor of terrorism in these areas. North Korea is an unstable neighbor, but not a military threat. In short, Bush's axis of evil is not Putin's axis of evil, and Russian and American purposes began to diverge. Now, Russia's opposition to the war against Iraq is well known, and I shall not dwell on it here. Instead, I'd like to turn briefly to the Commonwealth of Independent States, because it is here that Russia perceives not just divergent purposes, but that U.S. policy infringes on Russia's vital national interests. Since 1991, there has been a revival of religion in Central Asia. The revival was a natural and potentially stabilizing factor, as it filled an ethical void that the collapse of the communist value system had left. Shortly after independence, however, a civil war broke out in Tajikistan that pitted the former communist elite against an opposition force containing strong Islamic groups. This conflict led the four other Central Asian states to outlaw most opposition parties and movements, halting the development of political opposition. Defeated Tajik rebels took refuge across the border in Afghanistan, as did the outlawed movement, Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. Russia intervened in the Tajik war, and its troops guard the border between Tajikistan and Afghanistan. In 1999 and 2000, vowing to establish an Islamic state in the Fergana Valley, the IMU launched military actions from Afghanistan through Tajikistan into Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan. Russia established a counterterrorism center, but it had neither the capabilities nor the political will to intervene. From that moment, however, it was clear that there was a terrorist threat not just in Chechnya, but also in Central Asia. The war against terrorism in Central Asia changed radically after 9/11, when the United States discovered that it wanted to use air bases in Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. And President Putin, despite opposition from his military advisors, swiftly gave his consent. In late November 2001, it was widely reported that the IMU's military leader had died from wounds received during the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, and it seems unlikely that IMU infrastructure has survived the bombing campaign. For Russia, then, at that moment, the war in Central Asia, the war against terrorism in Central Asia became far less serious. And the disquiet about the continued involvement of the USA in Central Asia began to grow. It seems unlikely that the United States will withdraw from Uzbekistan or Kyrgyzstan in the near future, not only because of continued anxiety about Afghanistan, but also because of its interests in the resources of the Caspian Sea. I've already mentioned that U.S. military advisors have been in Georgia since 2002 to train forces there for anti-terrorist operations. Russia, therefore, no longer exercises sole influence in either Central Asia or in the Caucasus. Now, these are areas that Russia deems to be within its legitimate sphere of interest, and it is in the context of the U.S. presence in the Commonwealth of Independent States, in its pursuit of its war against terrorism, and in the context of Western objections to the manner in which Russia chooses to fight its counterterrorism campaigns, that the differences between Russia's and America's war against terrorism threaten to become, for Russia, an infringement of Russia's vital national interests. So it only remains for me to draw my gloomy conclusions. I'd like to begin by pointing out that there is a logical contradiction in Russian views about its war against terrorism. Moscow both depicts its war in Chechnya as part of the global war against terrorism and insists that the war is its internal affair and resists advice about how it should be prosecuted. America, too, of course, rejects advice about what policy it should follow against terrorism. But the consequences for Russia, as for America, is that its war against terrorism has a negative effect on its relations with other states, and this is a consequence that America is in far better shape to be able to withstand than Russia is at the present time. Second thing I'd like to point out is that a war against terror is absurd. To quote Martin Wolf again, one cannot fight abstract nouns. A struggle against terrorists cannot be won by military means. If it could, the conflict against Al-Qaeda would already be over. So great is U.S. conventional preponderance. And indeed, so would Russia's war against Chechen terrorists, because for all Russia's weakness, there is no doubt that it is militarily stronger than Chechnya. This doesn't mean that there are easy political means by which to defeat terrorism. In the case of Chechnya, it is particularly difficult because three groups are said to have an interest in the continuation of the war. It is argued that federal Russian forces themselves have very strong incentives to remain in Chechnya because they get higher pay and accelerated pension schemes for serving in an active area. They're also alleged to be involved in trade of oil products and to carry out extortion raids on local villages. These conditions, it is argued, motivate the troops to sustain the conflict in Chechnya. The second group have been called the Kadyrovtsy, in other words, followers of the assassinated pro-Russian president of Chechnya, Kadyrov, and his son, Ramzan. They are alleged to compete with the Russian federal forces, often carrying out their own raids on Chechen villages, and they too benefit from the war continuing. The warlords and the terrorists and their followers also need the war in Chechnya. They differ now very greatly from the naive village rebels of the 1990s whose political agenda was independence for Chechnya. The war in Chechnya, in short, has become a self-fulfilling prophecy because since 1997-1998, Islamic groups have become predominant in the region. This doesn't mean, when I say Islamic groups, that Al-Qaeda is predominant in the region. Indeed, Al-Qaeda is a parallel rather than the central movement. According to Tom Duval, the presence of two Arabs among the 31 terrorists who carried out the hostage-taking in Beslan is probably an accurate reflection of the proportion of international to homegrown forces in Chechnya today. Now, there is one school of thought that argues that there is, in fact, a fourth group that perpetuates the war in Chechnya, and this is a group situated in Moscow. The argument goes that Russia's war against terrorism is not about winning it, it is about having it. The argument is that Vladimir Putin arrived in the Kremlin with a clear perception that Russia's very existence was threatened and that the only way to save it was to re-centralize the state through firm administrative control. Putin needed a lever to do this, and the war against terrorism provided the lever, and it continues to do just that. Moreover, the war against terrorism contributes significantly to bolstering Putin's support in Russian society. It is a fact that in 1996, the only way Yeltsin could win a second term as Russian president was by ending the first war against Chechnya. In 2000, on the other hand, the second war against Chechnya gave Putin what was previously unheard of in Russia, and that was a first-round victory in the presidential election. His support has barely fallen since then. According to this school of thought, it is only when Putin believes that he has succeeded in re-centralizing the state, or when his public support begins to wane, that he will begin to seek a political means to end the war. When that time comes, he will have to look to the silent majority of Chechens, who are the victims both of Russian forces and of the Kadyrovtsi in this war in Chechnya. They are the people he will need to court if he really wants to eradicate terrorism, rather than looking to the people he appoints from Moscow. The struggle against terrorism can ultimately only be won in the hearts and minds of those who support terrorists. It's only when the people inclined to support the terrorists begin to view them as the greater, not the lesser of two evils, that terrorism will end and that Russia can bring its war against terrorism to an end. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Margot. We let those who have to leave, leave, and then we'll open up for questions. We'll do about 20 minutes of questions. Okay, we have stewards both here. Could you show yourselves? Yeah. And upstairs with microphones. Please use the microphones when you are asking questions. I'll start with a quick question of my own before moving on to the audience. With regard to what you were saying, Margot, at the very end, the potential or lack thereof of a political solution in Chechnya. I mean, one thing that's always struck me is that saying what you will about Putin and Putin's motives, there are a number of reasonably intelligent people around Putin who must be seeing by now that the military effort in Chechnya is not going anywhere. What do you see as a possibility if Putin's popularity should decrease? And there are indeed some signs now that his popularity ratings are slipping in Russia. What do you see as the potential headlines for a peace initiative coming out of Moscow? I'm not asking really about what the Chechens would respond to, but what would be possible in a Moscow setting?
I think that Putin has a problem partly, I mean, I'm not sure I think you're right that he's surrounded by people who probably recognize that the war is a failure. One of the things I haven't spoken about is the extent to which the war has radicalized Russian society itself, and the extent to which the anti-Chechen feeling that prevails amongst most Russians is almost impenetrable. There is no reasoning against it. I think that he's got a problem because what he has singularly done is to make it impossible to have a dialogue with Maschadov, who, to all intents and purposes, since there hasn't been a locally run election, is still the elected president of Chechnya. What is clear is that he will have to widen the dialogue, and he will have to do it, I think, at a kind of grassroots level, because anybody now in Chechnya who talks to the Russians in a cooperative manner themselves become a target of being labeled as pro-Moscow collaborationist. So there is a tremendous problem. It is a lot harder now than it would have been in the year 2000.
You have a question down here.
Well, what you said was your last point, saying about how Putin needs the war. This leads on to the obvious conspiracy theory, obviously, about those bombs which went off in Moscow and those apartment blocks in September 1999. Of course, but Boris Berezovsky, the oligarch living in London, okay, well, who of course has rather axed a grudge against Putin. Of course, he of course is the prime proponent of the idea that the bombings were carried out by the FSB. So, I was just interested what your thoughts on that matter were.
Moscow is of course the very place where conspiracy theories reign. I've certainly seen enough quite convincing television programs, investigative reporting, and read enough reports to suggest that there was some security service involvement, if not in the bombs that actually went off, certainly in the one in Rostov, which failed to go off. I don't think that it was inspired by the Kremlin, but I think it can't be excluded that the security services thought that they wanted to restart the war. I mean, the damage that was done to Russian national pride by the defeat in the first war was palpable, and it was felt particularly by those people who are charged in most societies with winning wars. And so there were certainly a number of people who wanted the war to begin again. There is a chance, but no more than that, they had something to do with these terrorist bombs. Boris Berezovsky, by the way, I should say, has also been part of a conspiracy, in that it is argued that it was Berezovsky that persuaded Basayev to launch the attack on Dagestan, which then led to the war against Chechnya. One should also bear in mind that Berezovsky masterminded Putin's election in the first presidential election. So he may then have fallen out with Putin, but he has not always been so opposed to him.
Have a question on that.
It seems that Russia lately is trying to increase its influence in the Middle East. I'm sorry. It seems that Russia has been lately trying to increase its influence in the Middle East, mainly by ways of weapon supplies, and this includes not only the nuclear reactor in Bushehr, but also a large weapons deal with Syria, and I've heard talks of weapons deal with the revived Palestinian Authority. My question is, do you feel that Russia is going back, reviving its Cold War patterns of Soviet influence in the Middle East in order to oppose Western influence? And since the countries we're referring to are mainly Syria and Iran, do you feel that this will bring to a clash with the West?
I think that it is certainly the case that Russia wants to increase its influence. But I think that this is a general pattern and that it isn't related to the Middle East. I think the Middle East provides the opportunities rather than is the cause of Russia's attempt to increase its influence. I think Russia has two aims. One is to be seen to be a great power, and great powers have multiple relations with a number of states, and I think that's a very active aim of Russian foreign policy. The economic motive is also extremely active, because one of the things that has worried the Russian leadership immensely is the extent to which their economic relations with the outside world resemble those of less developed countries, because it is so predominantly dependent upon raw resources. Russia has a problem in that it is competitive on world markets in very few areas of production. One of those areas of production is arms, and the other is its nuclear technology. So the economic motives, I think, should not in this case be completely discounted. The return, I think, to the Cold War is not just on the Russian side, but also on the perceptions with which Russia's policy in the rest of the world are regarded by other people and other states.
Please. While it's clear that Western and Russian agendas on the war on terror don't coincide, wouldn't you say that, nevertheless, the Western partners in the coalition need Russia's cooperation, both in the war on terror and more generally on matters of non-proliferation? And would you say that it's likely that the Western partners impose a degree of conditionality on Russia? If Russia doesn't move in the democratic direction that the Western partners would like to see, is it possible that the Western partners would, for example, withhold economic cooperation, which Russia wants? And Condoleezza Rice hinted at this before the summit last week, but then, as you said, at the summit, nothing of the sort materialized.
I think the West needed Russia rather more in the war on terrorism when it was concentrated on Afghanistan than it does now, but it certainly does need Russia, Russian cooperation to prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and particularly to keep what are colloquially known as loose nukes under control. I think that the developments in Russian-American relations have been very interesting, because immediately after Bush's re-election, it was said that Russia was undergoing America was undergoing an agonizing reappraisal of its relationship with Russia, and there were all sorts of hints and statements that, in fact, America had now lost patience with Russia, and was about to take a very strict line with Russia. Interestingly enough, of course, at the end of the reappraisal, it turned out that there was not going to be much change. And the difference in Bush's tone I don't know how he managed to change from Brussels to Bratislava, but between Brussels and Bratislava, something indeed happened, and his tone in the summit, after the summit, was very different. On the question of conditionality, I have a kind of a romantic, idealistic streak that says, yes, they should do it. But I think I'm pretty sure that all that would happen is that Russia would dig its heels in, and that it would have counterproductive effects. I mean, I often think that if the West understood that every time they support a Russian leader, the Russian leader loses popularity in Russia, and that every time the West, particularly the United States, opposes a Russian policy, that policy becomes very popular in Russia, that they would perhaps take a more sophisticated view of how they should relate to Russia.
So maybe opposing Putin then would be the right thing to do.
Absolutely.
Please.
Can you comment at all on the relationship between Russia and China in the context of the Central Asian
It is, I mean, clearly the Uyghur problem plays large, and I'm sure that Ani should really answer this question rather than me, plays rather more largely in the Sino-Kazakh relationship than in the Sino-Russian relationship. There has, of course, however, been the creation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is one of these organizations, the remit of which has increased with each meeting. However, like many regional organizations in the area, what is accepted and adopted and put on paper is very, very different from what actually happens in action. And I think one can reserve judgment about whether, in fact, this is beginning to become any more effective than the other regional organizations in the area. Russia is certainly using its relationship with China to show an independence streak from both the United States and the European Union. For example, there is a rather good trade relationship between Russia and China, but a very advanced arms agreement was reached in the last few weeks, simply because the Russians were very afraid that the EU was about to lift its arms embargo on China, and that Russia might lose out in the deal.
Can I just add to that, I spent a bit of time in Xinjiang this spring. It's very clear to me that the Chinese authorities are themselves creating a massive minority problem that is becoming increasingly difficult for them to solve, in part through the complete lack of understanding that Chinese authorities have with regard to the increasing role of religion among many young people, particularly Uyghurs, but not only Uyghurs, in Xinjiang, which goes together with the discovery of the Turkic cultural inheritance. But when, for instance, in Kashgar, in the main city, the main western city in Xinjiang, the Chinese are trying their best to block off the main square around the mosque so that people cannot get to the mosque to pray. I mean, you know, if you want to create a difficult situation, that's exactly what you do. So I'm fairly pessimistic with regard to that. Now, how this will play into Sino-Russian relations is quite something else. I mean, I tend to think like Marga, that much of this will, at least in the short run, center on the Central Asian republics and what will happen there, particularly what will happen in Kazakhstan, which is a main Chinese area of interest. Yes, please.
You seem to suggest that if Putin didn't have the identification between Chechnya and terrorism, that he may have tried to go out of his way to invent something like it, because of his overweening centralization, de-democratization program generally for Russia. Is that a correct interpretation or understanding of your argument?
Well, it's a kind of counterfactual, just in the sense that the Chechen terrorism was already there when he came to power. So I think I'd go no further than saying that it has served useful purposes for him, both in his rise to power in Russia in the year 2000 and in his ability to effect the kind of political change that he thought necessary since that time. The people who argue that the terrorist bombing that the bombing of the apartment blocks, particularly in Moscow, were actually inspired by the FSB, would probably answer to you that yes, and that's exactly what they've done. They've invented something that has then become a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm not entirely convinced that the proof that they actually did that is there to be able to say it with any assurance. So I'll say no more than it has served useful purposes.
One last question up there.
Do you think that the Yushchenko factor has and is continuing to cause a chill factor among the old guard in the post-Soviet territories and leading to raise their apprehensions against democratization in these countries?
Yes, and I think that if you were watching the Kyrgyz elections last weekend, or at least the run-up to the Kyrgyz elections, it was quite clear that there was considerable anxiety that a similar kind of movement would occur in Kyrgyzstan. And Moldova has been tipped. Interestingly enough, Moldova, the only country that has elected a communist government, has also been tipped as the next area. I think that there is an anxiety by the old guard, but I think in Central Asia, the old guard so clearly has the political situation under control that it's going to be quite some considerable time before they will be worrying about what kind of flower revolution or color revolution might occur. I think that as far as Russia and Ukraine is concerned, I certainly think that Russia was shown up very badly in the Ukrainian election, but that the Russia's behavior, its activity in Ukraine, should really be understood in the context of this American presence in the Commonwealth of Independent States and the second round of NATO expansion. This sense that the United States and its allies are encroaching upon an area where Russia believed there was general agreement that its influence should be predominant.
Margot, thank you very, very much for an excellent presentation, outstanding in clarity as always. It was a great pleasure listening to you tonight.
Thank you.
Now, before we break up, let me reassure Margot and all of you that, of course, the real reason why we placed Russia at the very end of this lecture series, there were two main reasons. One reason is, of course, the intrinsic significance of this topic. We had to go out on a high note, and the intrinsic significance of the speaker as well added to that. But it's also to prepare for what we are hoping to do next year, which is to build on the lecture series that we've had in 2004-2005, but try to look more outside the key issues of the Cold War in a limited European and American and Soviet setting. So do look at the website for the Cold War Center, and I think probably at the beginning of next term there should be information about the lectures that we're going to put on for next year. Thank you very much for coming.